This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
And the koan is a way of working with one's mind, to examine the mind by turning towards phenomena. In Buddhism, mind is all of reality. And so how do we examine reality? So one way is just to look at its qualities and characteristics, the shape of it, the texture of it, the color of it, the sound of it, the taste of it, and so on. But what we find in practice and what teachings reveal is that when we encounter through our senses the world, whether it's our interior or exterior world, that the experience that we have is profoundly altered, colored by our consciousness, by our what we call our conditioning. And so the koan is taken into meditation itself, where the mind is becoming free of its perception by letting the senses rest. And when the senses come to rest and there's only mind, and the mind in this case is why won't the tail pass through, then the truth of this question is revealed, not the idea of it, not the Buddhism of it, not the effect of it. I've also been, in working with these this koan, been drawing from a teaching of three aspects or three types of Mahayana, of compassion in Mahayana Buddhism, and drawing from the teachings of Musō Sōseki, who was a 13th, 14th century Zen master. And so we've talked about compassion that is directed towards sentient beings, which is compassion because it's directed towards sentient beings. It's not just directed towards oneself, but it's based in the belief that things are just as they appear. In other words, how we perceive them is their reality. And so it's offering compassion, but it's a compassion that's still sort of embedded in all of our ideas and beliefs. The second type is compassion based in the Dharma, where we've realized the emptiness of things, self and other, and all phenomena. But we've become attached to that now concept of emptiness, because the moment that the realization of emptiness becomes conceptualized, that is the only thing we can attach to. One can't attach to emptiness itself, but only to the idea of it. And so although this type of compassion is deep because it's realized the inherent emptiness of all things, including suffering itself, the attachment to that emptiness becomes a limiting factor, a kind of blindness. And then the third type of compassion is that which compassion without any object at all. What might that be? And so when we begin practicing, I spoke a little bit earlier about the First Noble Truth, life is dukkha, that life is, and all of everything that we can experience, that is, has within it our eventual disappointment and dissatisfaction, because the things that we want, that are we see as positive in our lives, we want to preserve and keep, and the things that we don't want, we want to avoid, and we're not successful at either of those. Not because we're not successful, but because the very nature of that attempt is based on a false view, false meaning not true. Not true in terms of Buddhist teaching, but not true in terms of the way reality is. And so it is never going to be possible that we will gain ultimate satisfaction and joy by holding on or negating. And so in the beginning, although we're still very much wedded to our ideas, in fact, we don't even see them. We're wedded to our beliefs. We don't even see them. They've become so integrated. And this is not the fault of you or me. This is just human consciousness. Right? We have so integrated, so absorbed every experience, every message, every image we've seen, every advertisement, every, you know, teaching at school and parents and all the experiences of everything, that it's just become completely integrated. And in that, it becomes invisible. And so that's why the Buddha spoke about habitual patterns of mind. Habitual because we no longer have to think. I mean, isn't that what reactivity is? It's not a, I don't decide to react to you with anger. I just am angry. And so when we begin practicing and taking up this teaching of life as dukkha and that it's possible to liberate ourselves from that, we're still in that mind view, in that worldview. Everything seems to exist just as it appears, which means outside of me. Even my thoughts seem to appear as solid, powerful objects and seem to exist outside of me. I know that they're in my mind, but my experience of them is as something other. And so we begin to enter into that study of mind, of non-attachment, of taking responsibility, of faith. Faith in the possibility, faith in the teachings, faith in the truth that samsara is not neither an accurate reflection of reality, nor is it ever going to be satisfied. And so everyday practice is to begin to loosen our grip on all of that, to begin to soften our fears, to reveal our false views. I talked a little bit about the Buddha's teaching on anything within Buddhism the Buddha said or within practice that is going to be beneficial has to have certain aspects. And one of those is that it helps us to become disenchanted, like less enamored, less infatuated with our thoughts, with our views, and so on. But we're still embedded in seeing and believing that things are autonomous and separate. But every day that we're practicing, it's within our sangha, we're also encountering teachings. Avalokiteshvara, doing deep prajnaparamita, clearly saw the emptiness of all the skandhas. Every aspect of that path by which we come into contact with our world and then come to consciously know it and have an opinion about it and act upon it is empty of self, of other, of independent existence, of its own power. So even though we're still within a view that ultimately, you know, based on our experience, appears to be separate and distinct, we're encountering teachings which are sort of saying something else. And so within the midst of still taking things as real, there's this teaching of prajnaparamita. Dogen says to study the way is to study the self. And so as we study the self at this point in our practice, why won't this tail pass through? All of these huge, bulky aspects of this buffalo, the ox, the self, have passed through this window. Right? The head, the horns, the body, the legs. And we thought, that was the hard part. How are we ever going to get that through? How are we ever going to let go of these aspects that have seemed so dominating, so intractable? But with time and practice, they pass through. But the tail, this tiny, insignificant seeming tail, won't pass through. And so as we practice, some things drop away easily. Some things with a little more effort, a little greater perseverance. Some things seem to have a life of their own. Right? They appear, I practice, they persist, seemingly despite my efforts, or they pass away, but only to return again, to return again, to return again. And we get flummoxed by that. What's going on? Why is that happening? Bodhidharma said that when we encounter deep entanglements, don't be surprised, because they make sense. And what he meant by that was that when we understand karma, the nature of karma, and how in every moment what arises, arises perfectly in accord with its karma, and perfectly in accord with the conditions that have made it possible for that to arise, whether it's a thought, whether it's a war. So it doesn't, arising perfectly doesn't mean that we experience it as good, or that it is good, but it arises in a perfect accordance with its nature and the nature of this world. And so he's saying, don't be surprised, because it's arising because it must when those causes and those conditions are present. What if those causes and conditions change? Then what arises? What if those causes and conditions cease? Then what arises? To study the self is to forget the self, Dogen says. And so within objects and sounds, within our experiences of them, within the mind that begins to grapple and understand and experience them as good or bad, within our strategies about whether we want that or don't want that, and within our consciousness, forgetting the self is to realize there is no self in any of those moments, in any of those activities, you might say. There's no soul, there's no essence, there's no permanent something. Forgetting means to cease creating. It means to realize beyond the constructed sense of I and what is happening to and defining this sense of I, and to realize there is no I. Here, which the second type of compassion is realizing the emptiness of things, why won't the tail pass through? When we see, when we don't understand the real nature of things, it's easy to understand why it won't pass through. Because we're still holding on, we still believe. But when we've realized that it has no self-nature, it has no power of its own, why won't it pass through? The tail, the window, the buffalo, where are they when the self is forgotten? A student once asked a master, where have all the ancestors gone? And the master said, what? What? When there's no abiding, no permanent nature in thoughts and emotions, in anything, there's no conflict, there's no pain, there's no possibility of helping someone. There's no obligation, there's no responsibility. And this is not yet liberation, enlightenment, or the bodhisattva life. And so, Suseki said, this is limited by an adherence to the idea of non-substantiality. So this is what I talked about in the previous two talks. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, Dogen says, to realize self and other, the body and mind of self and other as one. When the dharmas advance and realize the self. And so training, we can think of these three types of compassion as being sequential. We start and everything seems like, you know, shit happens. Just try and stay out of the way of it. And then we realize, no, things are not as they seem, as the Buddha said. They have an illusory quality, illusory in the sense that we perceive them not in a way that's not true. Not because our senses are wrong or because we're wrong, but because our consciousness has been infiltrated. And that infiltration infiltrates everything that we experience. And that's just a universal experience of human beings. You can be a really good person and still be deluded. Living a very good life and still be deluded. Deluded isn't a crime. It's what happens when we don't have a way to see what is hidden, to see what is difficult to see. An old master says, something is not as good as no thing. And no thing is to go beyond all thingness, including the thingness of no thing. Beyond any separate reality, beyond any objectification of or to, towards emptiness. To go beyond not knowing, to go beyond Dharma and Buddha. To not establish any self in any experience and to be free of not establishing. This is Prajnaparamita. And so the third type of compassion is objectless compassion. And Soseki says, objectless compassion occurs when, following the realization of enlightenment, the compassion that is an inherent virtue of your own self-nature manifests itself and functions naturally to liberate other sentient beings, even when there is no conscious striving to do so. So there's no sense of doing. There's no sense of doing it for you or to receive something. No conscious striving. It is like the moon, which equally casts its reflection on water everywhere. Thus, in spreading the Dharma, there's no interaction between teaching or no connection between teaching and not teaching. And in liberating people, there are no notions of benefiting or of not benefiting. You see, so in this type of compassion, this objectless compassion, the whole notion of doing and being done to, of giving and receiving, is going beyond even unity, and it's just action. It's been so integrated. And that this capacity is our basic nature. And it may be hard to imagine, and yet for all of us there are moments where there's just response. There's no sense of before and after. There's no sense of what's going to come to you because of this. Or even what's going to happen to the other person. There's no plan. There's no expectation. There's just response. What training does is helps us to go deep within these sort of passing moments of what you might call wisdom or grace. And rather than being sort of wonderful accidents, of actually entering into the basis, the source, your mind, and training in how to release all that is happening between those accidents, right, that's obstructing them. So Seki says, this is true compassion. Those who practice this directed towards sentient beings, or compassion based on the Dharma, these previous two types, are obstructed by such compassion and cannot realize objectless compassion. In other words, something still must be relinquished. This is what is meant by the maxim, minor compassion hinders great compassion. The Chinese master Baizhang had the same thing in mind when he warned to not be greedy for petty gains and merits. And this is why the Mahayana speaks of the great vehicle. In other words, as we practice and begin to develop our lives transform, to not become self-satisfied along the way with what would be considered smaller transformations, smaller insights. Not because they're not real or valid or because they're transformative, but because there's so much more. And so here, if there is no self, no object, no purpose, no reward, why won't the tail pass through? And so we can think of this koan, really any koan, from the perspective of what's happening for the practitioner, you, me, at different points along the journey. And this is why, you know, any deep, true teaching can really be engaged at every point along the way and continue to reveal, continue to receive our, take our seeking, our inquiry, and bring us to a deeper understanding. And at each step along the way, of course, we have to have faith. I spoke about this a little bit. Faith is such an important part of Buddhism. And that surprises a lot of people who come into Buddhism because they understand that Buddhism is non-theistic. And so sort of relate faith to traditions based in God, faith in God. And so what is faith in if there's not an outside power? Well, clearly it's faith in the seat of true power, which is you, your Buddha mind, in the Dharma as a teaching of that truth which is within you, in the Buddha. But it's also faith in what is not yet clear, but can become clear. And so it's faith in your capacity to see what you have not yet seen. It's faith in my capacity to let go of what I have not yet let go of. How come? How can I have that faith? Because I've seen, looking back, that I have seen what was hidden and that I have let go of what I had not let go of. And I've not just done that once. I've done that again and again, particularly if we're practicing. And so why would we think that that would ever stop? That there would ever be an end to that? And so it's faith in beyond what we know at present, in beyond what can even be known. I quoted Christian Wiman, a Christian poet, who I was listening to an interview of and reading some of his poetry, and he spoke about faith, and he said, for him, faith is not a state of mind, but an action in the world. So it's not something theoretical or abstract or conceptual, but it's actually something that he's doing and doing in the world. He said, and it's a movement into and towards the world. He said, the way he's defined it for himself is to think of belief, of the beliefs that we have as having an object. I believe in something. And if we look closely, we usually see that my belief in something has a lot to do with what that something is going to do for me. So it's not just a theoretical belief that the Dharma is true, but it's a belief that the Dharma is going to give me what I want it to give me. And he says, faith doesn't have objects. Faith is an orientation of one's life. It's a way of aligning oneself, of being in the world. He said, you can think of it as an energy, something that moves in you, that you experience, that you can work with as an energy, like a vow. You could think of a vow or an expressed aspiration as a way of taking an energy and moving it into a particular form which has the power to create something good. You can think of Zazen as taking the energy of suffering and bringing it into this mountain form of stillness and silence. He says, but however you want to think about it, think of it as objectless. And this is really the heart of compassion. It's wholehearted commitment, but without an object or a basis. It's deep resolve, constancy, but having nowhere to take a stand. And from that nowhere to take a stand, you step forward. And so Wu Man says, if you can see into this koan, why won't the tail pass through? What is passing through? What is crossing from this shore of samsara to the shore of enlightenment? What is reaching the peak of the mountain? All of these metaphors that are used in Buddhism to communicate the sense of path, of journey. And they communicate that, right? In other words, if you're going to travel, get off your butt. You got to get on your butt, but in a different way. Right? In other words, you have to sit, to turn in, to see. And so it communicates that, which is quite important and accurate. So it means my faith, you know, to have faith is great. Now what's next? Right? No, that I have faith, and now what do I do? What do I do? I remember in my own searching before I encountered the Dharma, of this deep searching, right? And looking and looking and reading books and going to churches and just, does anybody know what's going on? And when I encountered the Dharma, I realized that I had known without being able to articulate it that I needed to do something. And that what I encountered in the Dharma is, do this. There is a path. And so he says, if you can penetrate into this and open your eye to it, you'll then be able to repay the four obligations above and the three existences below. And the four obligations, and of course this is an ancient Chinese teaching, is the four obligations are your parents, your sovereign, little troublesome. What are we going to do with that? So, but we do have an obligation. I mean, we have a mutual obligation to each other, right? And so we could also expand this to be country, earth, everything that we are responsible to. The third obligation is to people and then to the three treasures. So basically, it's saying that we are in a state of obligation to those things that we're in relationship to, that we rely upon. Those things that both order our lives and supply us with life and give our lives meaning. We are in mutual obligation. That's not a bad thing. It's an essential thing. And the three existences are form, formlessness, and desire, which relate to realms of existence, but just think of them as different aspects of samsara. And so what he's saying is if when we understand, then we can repay. We can begin to repay our debt for this life that we've received. In other words, to be a beneficial member of this world. So how does this objectless compassion manifest? How do you aspire truly from the depth of your heart, because your life depends upon it, without goal? How do you commit and follow through on that commitment without expectation? How do you serve without reward? These are practices and they're realizations. And so we can practice these in faith that they're true, even though we may not yet believe in them. And I remember distinctly and over time not believing in the possibility to aspire without a goal. It's like, no, that's just not happening. I mean, basically, I wasn't honest enough to say that to my teacher. You know, so I would like, you know, knowingly, deeply. Of course. And then go back to my cushion and like establish the goal and, you know, march forward. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, that because the Dharma is true, if we practice it reasonably faithfully, then even almost despite that part of ourselves, which is entrenched, which is not yet willing to release, that we will be entering into and opening up to that very reality, that truth that we don't yet have faith in. How else could this happen? When everything seems endowed with an autonomous nature outside of ourself, then attaching to goals and expectation and demanding rewards makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. That's why our basic, you know, society, you don't have to explain it. You know, I give you this, you give that something back. If you don't do that, then we got a problem. And there's truth to that, right? There's an agreement in that that works as long as everybody agrees and follows through. When I perceive a lack, it makes sense that something is missing. And so I go looking for something to fill that gap. That makes sense. And in our world, I mean, there's no end to the possibilities of things that I could go looking for to fill that gap. And then once I've obtained it, then hold on to it, right? Don't lose that. When I meet a problem, something that's getting in my way, and something that I might just really deeply care about, something that's good, it makes sense that I would try and manipulate, control, subdue, destroy if necessary, avoid if nothing else is possible. That all makes sense. But if it really made sense, then it would all work. And we would be living in an enlightened society based on the fact that responding to the world that way was based in that being the way the world works. The fact that that's not, doesn't seem to add up is evidence. And when we see the world that way, then compassion at some point is going to become a chore, a burden. It's exhausting. It's certainly going to disappoint you. And this is what Vimalakirti speaks of as sentimental compassion. And I think this is what we so struggle with in terms of compassion, is exactly those things. And so what is objectless compassion within the path of non-grasping? To be at peace with the world when the world is not at peace. To be at peace within yourself when within yourself you find conflict. So first, you're not going to figure it out. Everybody's tried, right? People much, much smarter than me and much more, you know, willing to dedicate everything to it have tried. We're not going to figure it out. But it can be practiced. It can be realized. All things without essence. All things impart something when we look for to fulfill our desires. But everything that they impart, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. So it's like you come so excited to the party, and as soon as you walk in, the first thing that everybody says is, this is going to end. Right? Or you're born, and because you're an enlightened being, you can understand language right away. And the first thing your mother says is, you're already dying. Right? Now, we think that's not a good idea. Right? Because it's true, but it would sadden us to death. Right? And it would if we don't know what that means and if we don't know how to respond. And yet we do find that out pretty early. Pretty early we do find that out. And rather than give up, it actually intensifies this life. And so without permanence as a possibility, what now is our motivation? Without true reward, in other words, a reward that you can take and keep and it will save you. It will fill that void. Without the possibility of that, what is our motivation? When we attach to the sense, and I just got an email this morning, by the way, from someone that I have yet to respond to, who basically said, because all things are empty, why do you speak of social action? Why do you speak of responding to the world? Because all things arise perfectly in perfect accordance with their time and place, with their karma and conditions. And so isn't everything that's happening supposed to be happening? Right? So that's not yet not understanding Buddhism. And that's not a unique misunderstanding by any means. Because all things are empty, why respond? That question is asked in the Vimalakirti Sutra. And Vimalakirti says, because you know suffering is empty, it's not necessary. And because you know the most powerful thing possible. And when you've realized that, everything is changed. And so objectless compassion, not based on a goal or expectation or reward, is to be on a vast horizon of possibilities, on a path that is endless rather than on a process that leads to a goal, in which every action is changing, is influencing, is contributing to the alleviation of that suffering, rather than fixing the problem, which is a paralyzing task. Compassion itself is the path. Dogen says, when good is done, it contains all that is good. Although good itself is formless, empty, when it's done, it attracts more good faster than a magnet attracts iron. Its power is stronger than the strongest wind. All of the accumulated karma throughout the earth, in mountains, rivers, the world, and lands, cannot obstruct the power of good. In practicing objectless compassion, in wanting to practice objectless compassion when you are still seeking an object, there has to be faith, and there will be doubt. We will encounter doubt. If you're not encountering doubt, you may not be practicing. Christian Wiman wrote about this in a way that I found very, very nice. He says, he's talking about his own process. He said he wrote several poems where God is actually expunged from the poem. One poem he wrote began, "There is no consolation in the thought of God." And then he wrote others, he says, and he says, "I don't take any credit for this idea." He said, but these poems not only didn't sort of hold up the idea of heaven, they actually mocked the notion, made fun of the idea of heaven. And then he would write these poems and then he would read them and he'd think, "Oh my God, what's going on? What am I doing? Where are these coming from? Why am I writing this?" And then he says, "I think it's very much that doubt is so woven in with faith that it can't be separated. And I'm convinced that the same God that might call me to sing of God at one time will at another time call me to sing of godlessness. That as we seek our original nature, Buddha nature, and have faith in that, that very path will at times demand that we will lose that faith. Not as something that's happening outside of us, not that the Dharma has a plan, not that we have a plan, but just because they're inseparable, they're non-dual. He says, sometimes I think that all of this energy that's going on, different people to try and find different way of naming and speaking about their beliefs, he says, I think it may be the case that God just calls some people to unbelief in order that their faith can take new forms. And so we see this in practice, that before we can, in a sense, live, we have to die. Before we can have what we have, before we can have, in a sense, our being, the self has to collapse. As the Buddha said, the timbers of the house have to break apart. Before we can really discover the depths of true compassion, we have to lose our compassion. There will be such moments before we can truly understand this Dharma and fully integrate it. We have to lose practice. And there are such moments. And to have faith in that is a wondrous thing. On one's own, that's very, very difficult. But in practicing together and engaging the teachings, in seeing it in others and ourselves, just hearing those words. You know, I remember when I would hear my teacher talk about things that I was secretly, you know, distressed over. And he would, or I would go into Doksan just distressed about something, and he would like, yeah, you know, like, that's not that interesting. And it's not that interesting because it's boring, it's because it's of course, naturally. And there's both a relaxing in that, and there's a little bit of a collapsing because, oh, I'm not special. But more, there's a relaxing. Oh. And so to have reverence for that which cannot be known. Our capacity to respond in this time and place. To understand that everything, from a Buddhist perspective, everything, because it arises perfectly in accord with causes, and because it is impermanent, it's not fixed, it means its life is not set. It's not predetermined. Suisei talked about this yesterday in terms of karma. There is no free will in the sense that we can, you know, as long as we're deluded, act out of, you know, separate from our conditioning, but we have choice within our conditioning. And so those of you who woke up this morning and thought, oh, maybe I'll just kick back, right? And then you came. And it's not that kicking back is wrong, and this is right, but that recognize, experiencing that, we can make choices. And it, particularly if kicking back was not actually going to be good for you, whatever that might mean. Faith and doubt are non-dual. Doubt without faith can become despair, cynicism, apathy, destruction. Faith without doubt can become blind and unexamining. Can be unwilling to be self-critical or other critical. To be reflective and aware. What is this? What are we doing? What's working? What's not working? The tail that won't pass through, it should not be ignored. Just because it's small doesn't mean it's insignificant. If it passes through, it falls into a ditch. Having crossed over to the other shore, you realize you haven't taken a single step. Seeing your life transform, you realize you have not changed. But if it turns back, it's destroyed. If it doesn't pass through, then we can't liberate our lives. This tiny tale, how extremely marvelous. And so I wanted to say a little bit about this Dharma in action that we're going to do this afternoon, and I'm running out of time. So let me just say that this is, and was somebody going to say something? Okay. That this is really an invitation being offered by the Sangha, to the Sangha, to take up exactly this, compassion and wisdom, because they're inseparable. And along the way to both bring our faith and our capacity to address what needs to be addressed in our world and to do that together as a Sangha, as well as to bring forward our doubts in our capacity to do that, in the wisdom of our doing that, to bring it all and to make manifest these great teachings. In the same way that Krishna Wiman says that faith is to be active, it's to be active in the world, that compassion is just that, is precisely that. And compassion is inseparable from wisdom, and so we can't speak of liberating without it moving forward. And so there's an invitation. We're all invited to explore that. And I think the way it's going to be set up is that you can really step in, you know, for any part of it, to just see what's being offered and what's being presented and what you might be interested in being a part of. But that'll be made clear later. So I'll put that aside and let somebody else take that up so we can go down and have lunch. So thank you, everybody, for being here today. You know, it's doing this week by week, day by day, what you do in your own home, even whether you're a practitioner or not, everything that you do, anything that you do that is arises from a desire and is directed towards a desire to bring benefit to this world, right? To add more than we take, to reduce, to create less conflict and more peace. That creates a karma that is the power of good that Dogen is speaking of here, stronger than the strongest wind. So, thank you for your practice.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.